understand your world. News.
Economy.
Trends.
Politics.
I want to help you know what's happening and why.
Global affairs.
Discovery.
Health. Family.
Truth.
The Bible.
This will make your life better.
The future.
This is Trouble Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. On today's show, 2 weeks ago, The Atlantic magazine printed an interview with President Barack Obama that gave some insight into the West's nuclear negotiations with Iran. There were a lot of observers, including the Trumpet, that have criticized this deal for making it likelier that Iran is going to get nuclear weapons. Well, we're going to look at this Atlantic interview to see how the president tried to refute his detractors. And this interview definitely helps you to see what we can expect this summer as these negotiations continue. After that, China is on a gold-buying rampage. Not just buying gold, but they're buying gold mines, gold producers. Last year, they set up their first international gold exchange. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Robert Morley about why this is important and what it portends for the future of the world economy. Then we're going to have a conversation with a fascinating Egyptian-American author who has carved out a curious niche by writing something I find very enjoyable, the aphorism. This is a little bit of pithy, thought-provoking wisdom that's often short enough to fit in a tweet. I like to end each Trumpet Hour with an aphorism, but today we're going to have an extended conversation about the joys and intrigues of this potent little art form. We're also going to try to answer a tough question from a Trumpet reader, and we'll finish off by giving you some recent research about a dangerous activity that you might be doing right now, but that you can easily take steps to put your foot down and take action. It'll make your life more enjoyable and might even make it a little bit longer. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Our top story concerns Jeffrey Goldberg's May 21st interview in The Atlantic magazine with President Barack Obama. The president is leading efforts to negotiate a deal with Iran. There's a big deadline later on this month, June 30th, to try to secure this deal. And this is presumably about trying to deny Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, a very important strategic and security issue. But there are a lot of observers, including the Trumpet, that see things about these negotiations that make it actually likelier that Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon. And on top of that, just in the more immediate term, it's meant to remove sanctions on Iran. This is going to inject about $150 billion into this country's economy. And this is such an important thing to watch. There's so much at stake here. Certainly, Israel's security is very important, but really the whole Middle East is changing because what we're seeing is basically an alignment between America's foreign policy and the interests of Iran. And the fact that the United States is getting behind this and trying to strike this deal is empowering Iran in a way that is causing a lot of nations in the Middle East to have to recalculate their foreign policy. Now, this interview is well worth reading. Mr. Goldberg asks some excellent questions that brought out a lot of very revealing statements from the president, and I'd recommend that you read it. But also, we posted an article about this on thetrumpet.com. The title of the article is President Obama's Remarkable Defense of the Iran Nuclear Deal. You can read that online. It was posted today. And there's also a link within the article to the Atlantic interview. And I want to just bring out a few points here on today's show. We talked last week about how Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations in the Middle East they're responding to what's happening with Iran, and really we're seeing an arms race beginning to develop in this most unstable part of the world. Mr. Goldberg writes in his article, I asked Obama if the Saudis had promised him not to go down the nuclear path. He says, what are the consequences if other countries in the region say, well, you know what, they have 5,000 centrifuges, we're going to have 5,000 centrifuges. He says President Obama responded by downplaying these media reports. Like, the president doesn't even really believe this is happening. This is what President Obama said. There has been no indication from the Saudis or any other Gulf Cooperation Council countries that they have an intention to pursue their own nuclear program. Now, that it's interesting because there have been a lot of reports talking about the interest that these countries have in a nuclear program, and there have been Saudi officials that have made really very direct statements about this, but he basically says, no, it's not really happening. And what makes him so confident about this? This is what the president said. The protection that we provide as their partner, he's talking about Saudi Arabia, the protection that America provides as their partner is a far greater deterrent than they could ever hope to achieve by developing their own nuclear stockpile or trying to achieve breakout capacity when it comes to nuclear weapons. And they understand that. Now, that's an amazing statement after just in the last few years, we've seen Libya fall, we've seen Egypt fall a couple of times, we've seen Tunisia, recently Yemen fell to Iranian-backed militants. You just have to ask, how much is America's protection really worth? And any Middle Eastern country that is relying on America as its protection, really there's a lot of evidence that would surely make them think twice about that. America's protection, the president is saying that that is a greater deterrent than your own nuclear weapon. And I can't imagine that Saudi Arabia believes that way even a little bit based on what's been happening. And their actions would prove that. But Mr. Goldberg asked the president, on one hand, he says, you know, you say that this is a paraphrase, he said that the Iranian regime has venomous anti-Semitism. Now, that is a quote from President Obama. He actually said that about the Iranian leaders at one point. And Mr. Goldberg says, on the other hand, you say that Iran is practical, these are his words, and is responsive to incentive and shows signs of rationality. And Goldberg just said, I don't understand how these things fit together in your mind. How can you say that they're venomously anti-Semitic, which is an irrational mindset on one hand, and on the other say, well, they're rational people and that they can be worked with in the way that you wouldn't work with any nation. This is what President Obama said. Well, the fact that you're anti-Semitic or racist doesn't preclude you from being interested in survival. It doesn't preclude you from being rational about the need to keep your economy afloat. It doesn't preclude you from making strategic decisions about how you stay in power. You know, he's basically saying these guys operate by the same set of criteria as the rest of us. They're just as rational as the rest of us. And he really downplayed their anti-Semitism. He really downplayed the hate that they routinely publicize and proclaim. He said this, they may make irrational decisions with respect to discrimination, with respect to trying to use anti-Semitic rhetoric as an organizing tool. At the margins, where the costs are low, they may pursue policies based on hatred as opposed to self-interest. So he's basically saying, you know, they're only using anti-Semitism as an organizing tool. They're only doing that when the costs are low. But he said the United States is keeping the costs of anti-Semitism, the cost of expansionism and trying to extend Iranian hegemony in the region, we're keeping those costs really high because we're using sanctions, we're keeping the military option on the table. This is what President Obama said, and just ignoring the fact that he's actually trying to remove those sanctions and ignoring the fact that nobody believes this president is going to use the military in any meaningful way. And again, you look at the countries in the Middle East, you can be sure that Saudi Arabia, that Israel, that other nations in that region, they're not counting on the United States exercising a military option. They have no evidence to show anything other than that this president is not at all interested in getting the military involved in any meaningful way. Then the president actually uttered this gem of a statement. He said, you know, if you look at the history of anti-Semitism, there were a whole lot of European leaders, and there were deep strains of anti-Semitism in this country, talking about the United States. So he is making this moral equivalency between what Iran says and does and what you see in Europe or what you've seen in Europe historically and what you've seen in the United States. In other words, why single Iran out for those kinds of attitudes? They're just using anti-Semitic rhetoric as an organizing tool. And what they're really interested in, he said, is maintaining power and having some semblance of legitimacy inside their own country. You know, they're just motivated by money, economy, power, just like the rest of us, just like American politicians. They're not really driven by ideology. You can work with them. You just raise the cost of all of that talk about destroying the Jews and all of that. If you raise the cost high enough, then they're not going to do anything about it. We don't have to worry about it. So it's based on this sequence of logic. It's based on this reasoning that he's about to bring $150 billion into Iran's economy. Now, there are a lot of people looking at this and saying, there's no doubt but that a big chunk of $150 billion is going to go straight into exactly what Iran tends to spend its money on, and that is funding terror and extending Iran's power in the Middle East. But President Obama says, no, you don't have to worry about it. The Ayatollah is going to spend the money on making life better for Iranians. And Mr. Goldberg asked the president, well, I just don't know where your confidence comes from. And the president basically said, well, it's not automatically going into terror. You know, a lot of it has to go into improving the Iranian economy because that's what the leaders promised. That's their primary concern. There is just absolutely no evidence to support that position. How can anybody know that that money isn't going to go into terrorism, that it isn't going to go into buying more weapons? And in this interview, the president actually acknowledged what he called Iran's destabilizing activities. He talked about its nuclear program, the fact that they ship weapons to Hezbollah, the fact that they send agents into Yemen. He called them other low-tech asymmetric threats that they're very effective at exploiting. So they have a lot of weapons at their disposal that they're using to destabilize the region and beyond. But in the president's view, none of that matters. None of that justifies denying them sanctions relief. And why is that? He said it's because, well, all of these things are activities that they've been doing despite sanctions. In other words, the thinking is that the Iranians, they're sponsoring terrorism. Yes, they're creating problems. They're causing havoc. But you know what? They're doing all of these things on a limited budget. So what difference does it make? Let's just go ahead and relax these economic punishments. Extraordinary. This is the logic behind these negotiations. And I'm using the term logic very loosely. I'd like to encourage you to look at our May, June 2015 Trumpet Edition, an article in there by Brad McDonald called America's Chamberlain. And this article looks at the evidence. It just goes down and follows the pattern that this administration has established of actions that are actually aligning with the interests of the leaders in Tehran and that actually run counter to the interests of Israel and counter even to the interests of the United States. It's a very strong article, an excellent article with lots of compelling evidence and proof of this the point that he's making there. You just look at what's happening in Iran. You look at what's happening with these negotiations, and you can see where this is leading. I do want to encourage you to look at the article on this subject up today on thetrumpet.com called President Obama's Remarkable Defense of the Iran Nuclear Deal. This is Trumpet Hour. China is on a gold-buying rampage. It just signed a historic deal to further increase the flow of gold into China. Some people say it's positioning itself to back its own currency with gold. Now, this would have huge implications for the dollar, huge implications for the world economy. And I talked to the Trumpet's economy writer, Robert Morley, about this important trend, and I'd like to share that interview with you now. So, Robert, in last week's Trumpet Weekly, we have this article, U.S. Scared to Death as China Just Secured Larger Flow of Gold. And it's quoting this economist, Stephen Leeb, and he says, the Chinese are no longer content with just buying up all the available physical gold in the world. Instead, they want to gain direct access to gold through the largest producers in the world. He says, China is not doing this because they like to look at gold. They're doing it because they want gold to back the yuan, the Chinese currency. And he says, the headline should read, U.S. scared to death of China because it will be game over for the U.S. dollar and therefore U.S. world dominance once this nightmare unfolds. Could you help us to understand what it is about China buying gold that should instill such fear in U.S. consumers and U.S. decision leaders?
That's something that a lot of people in the United States don't understand the way we should, because the dollar is no longer backed by gold in America. There was a time in the United States where our money was backed by gold. The dollar was as good as gold, and that's what our financial system revolved around. But since 1971, when the United States came off the gold standard, the dollar now is what's called a fiat currency, or it's this currency that does not have anything solid behind it. And I think what Stephen's getting to in that piece is the credibility of the U.S. financial system can be measured in terms of how the dollar is doing compared to gold. With all fiat currencies, they're backed by faith. That's the world's major currencies today, the dollar, the euro. There's nothing solid behind it anymore. And certain money managers, financial experts are seeing what China's doing with their gold accumulations as a play to at least challenge the dollar supremacy, if not replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency.
Is this basically an acknowledgement that the fiat currency model is fundamentally flawed? As they're watching, say, quantitative easing, some of these policies that are pumping huge amounts of paper whatevers into circulation, mostly dollars, that it's an illusion of wealth creation that is not sustainable.
Right. China holds a couple of trillion dollars worth of U.S. Treasury bills, and they are afraid of the value of that disappearing. And that does happen with fiat currency systems. This does happen to paper money over time. And I think they are very afraid. And one of the ways that you try to protect yourself from something like that is to buy gold. Gold is something that's solid. It's real. It's there. It's a money that's been used as far back as human history records. And it's not something that can disappear with the click of a button. It's not something that disappears when governments print off money by the boatloads.
We've been talking about the loss in faith in the American dollar for quite a long time, and the fact that investors are looking for an alternative. Do you think that China is positioning itself to say, we would like to offer you something that actually has some lasting value to investors around the world?
Absolutely. I think that's their big selling point for the yuan, or I think it's going to be a big selling point for them. If you look at what they did last year with how they set up their new gold trading hub in Shanghai, this was something that they marketed to the world as an alternative to the Western bullion banks. And this was something that a lot of analysts looked at as a tool that China was going to exploit to increase the flows of gold into China. And that's exactly what has been happening in China over the last couple of years. If you look at last year, experts think that China imported or bought up domestic supply of like 1,700 tons of gold, which vastly dwarfs what any other central bank in the world. Just to put that number in context, the United States claims to hold about 8,000 tons in Fort Knox as our gold supply. So in 1 year, they think China may have absorbed somewhere around 1,700 tons last year, 1,900 tons. So China is definitely on a gold accumulating strategy. That's what it's working right now.
China seems to really go big when it comes to this type of thing. And they seem to have a mind to put their trust in these physical type assets. I'm just thinking about the story that came out about them accumulating and really having a monopoly on rare earths recently. And this is really important for a lot of high-end technologies that a lot of countries today are dependent on this. And China has basically positioned itself to own that market.
Yeah, absolutely. They own 97% of the rare earths market. Now you're seeing them make some of those same sort of moves in the gold industry. I think that article that you referenced talked about how the state-owned Chinese gold mining company recently cut two massive deals. This is just last week where they purchased a gold mine off of Barrick Gold, which is the biggest gold mining company in the world. They purchased a big operation down in Papua New Guinea. And then they cut a deal to buy the biggest undeveloped copper and gold project in the world in Mongolia. This is a very active accumulation strategy. And the Chinese, like you said, are masters of it. They exploit commodities. They think very long term. You can see it in their dealings with countries like Australia and how they manipulate the iron ore prices all the time. They manipulate the coal prices to political advantage. Even you'll see them stockpiling things like iron ore so that the state can make an announcement and say, okay, we're going to start selling it now. We're going to stop buying, and iron ore prices plunge down. And then you see the state-owned companies swooping in and buying assets. This is China's strategy. And you can just see from actions like that, it's not a benevolent power. This is economic warfare and competition at its highest level.
Well, wouldn't we have to view what China is doing in the context of other central banks making similar moves? You had recently Austria saying, well, we want our gold back from Britain. It wasn't too long ago, maybe a couple of years ago, that Germany said, we'd like to get our gold back from the United States. So there, it seems like this move, at least among some nations, not others, not all, but some maybe more forward-thinking nations, to repatriate their gold. This isn't just China that's making this move, but it's something that we're seeing in a broader context as well.
I think you're right. I think what we're seeing is the financial system, the global financial system built around the dollar, is for the first time in 30 years since the 1970s when we came off the gold standard, is being questioned. And not just questioned by average, you know, the average Joe on the street. These are high-level players. These are the financiers, the bankers, the CEOs, the elites of the global economy for the first time in decades are questioning whether this fiat system is actually sustainable. You know, can we have a global financial system built on the dollar where one country can print up as much money as it wants out of thin air to buy assets? But now the world's changing and we see these rising powers and they're saying this is an exorbitant privilege the U.S. has here, being able to print up money and buy things, inject it into the economy, and not suffer the consequences because we all have to use a dollar. And China's gold strategy is part of that. The Europeans now, for the first time, repatriating their gold, not selling gold anymore. You know, if you look at the United Kingdom, was famous for selling off its national stockpiles back in the early 2000s, right at the bottom. Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, the Western world, the English-speaking world, you know, the stockpiles are gone. They're not there. Even some of the Northern Europeans, the Scandinavians. But if you look at Europe as a whole, if you look at Germany, if you look at France, if you look at Italy, these nations have hung on very tight to their gold supplies. If you look at Russia now, I think they're listed at having about 1,000 tons, which puts them at probably number 10 or something on the world. But they've come a long way since they fell apart and after the Berlin Wall fell apart, and they're accumulating again. And it's a sign, I think, that the faith in the dollar around the world is starting to be questioned.
We certainly can expect a change, a big change at some point in the near future. The way that the economy is built right now, really on the dollar and on faith in the dollar, once that faith is shaken, something dramatic is on the horizon. Something is going to change. Well, thanks for your perspective. It's a pleasure to have you.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour on KPCG 101.3 FM from Edmond, Oklahoma. I'm your host, Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and thetrumpet.com. Some time ago, I was reading a book called How to Write Short by Roy Peter Clark, and it had this wonderful sentence in it. The small spirit is quick to misperceive an insult. The large spirit is slow to receive a compliment. And that sentence was written by a man named Yahya Lababidi. Now, I really enjoy short, pithy sayings. I enjoy little proverbs and aphorisms. So I encountered this sentence and I decided to tweet it. And soon after I did that, I received a reply from the author, Mr. Lababidi. And the two of us struck up a conversation. He actually sent me two books of short sayings that he has written, and I've gotten quite a lot of enjoyment out of these books. And I'd like to introduce you to this man, Yahya. He was born in Egypt and grew up there. He went to an American school in Cairo, but he actually worked as a speechwriter for the United Nations for several years. He has had several other writing jobs. But what got him into writing and what he has come back to time and again and what he's really gained some considerable notoriety for is the aphorism, this potent little art form. We had a wonderful conversation about aphorisms, and it ventured into all kinds of other interesting territory. We talked about thinking and about cultivating depth and several other subjects. I tried to squeeze this down into a length that we can fit on the program today. So I hope you'll enjoy some excerpts from my conversation with Yahya Lababidi. So I have with me here Yahya Lababidi via Skype from, where is it in Colombia?
I'm in Medellin. They call it the City of Eternal Spring.
Okay, so you can hear the quality of the sound that we're getting. If there's any problems, you can just blame it on Skype. But Yahya, yeah. I'm very thankful that you're joining me here. Looking at your book, this is your latest book called In Chrysalis. It starts with just trying to define what is an aphorism exactly, and it's probably something that has been somewhat fluid over the centuries. One definition that I thought was helpful at the beginning of this, it said aphorisms are expressions of profound critical thinking and literary prowess of their authors. They must be well-crafted and thought-provoking. And I feel like your aphorisms certainly fit that mold. How do you define it? How do you know when you're onto something that will make a good aphorism?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the generous introduction. Aphorisms, as I understand them, are quite simply what's worth quoting from the soul's dialogue with itself. So we walk around talking to ourselves in our head, and then at some point, you'll have a sentence, a good line, like you might have in conversation, that you think either sums up everything you've been thinking or groping for, and it can stand alone by itself. So for me, an aphorism is just that. It's a conclusion, but shorn of the entire argument, that somehow does the work by itself. And then you as a reader, you know, you stumble across it and you can sit and meditate on it or unpack it or even refute it, if you will, but it needs no further assistance from the author.
How have you found writing and composing these kinds of thoughts in the age of Twitter and in, say, the modern media environment?
I think, first of all, I'm very grateful to Twitter for no other reason than the fact that it's put us together and we're having this conversation. Something like Twitter, I mean, for me, was a godsend as an aphorist. First of all, people didn't know when I began doing this bizarre thing of, you know, composing these thoughts in this manner, and then it became a book. But with Twitter, where you have this constraint, so everyone is sort of a practicing aphorist. Now, you know, as with everything, it needn't be the same quality, but just the fact that they're accustomed to communicating in this short form means that they're more receptive to being to this art form, this brief manner of communicating. I think it's a time, it's an age of shortened attention spans.
So right.
The aphorism works in that context. But then again, the aphorism is devious because it can stay with you after you've read it for a much longer time.
We're accustomed to things being short. We want things shorter and shorter, but it's really more short and shallow. And what you have in an aphorism is something that's short and really pretty deep. So you don't only write aphorisms. You do write longer form. You write poetry. You write essays. And you said you started as a writer writing aphorisms. The very first book you wrote was Aphorisms. You've departed from that and gone into other realms, but you've come back to it. What is it that you find so compelling about it?
It seems to me the most intimate and pure way of communicating a thought and of self-expression. With an aphorism, I really feel that I'm just speaking to myself. And then, of course, once I take it apart from myself, if it's any good, then I realize that, it has the capacity to reach another and to be universal.
One of the quotes in the very beginning of your book, it says, an aphorism divides the totality of existence into a series of manageable chunks. You just mentioned the universality of an aphorism. How intrinsic is that to the success of a statement of this type?
Well, I think if they're any good, if we ask anything of artists, visual artists, musicians, writers, you're asking them not to get lost in their navel. You know, yes, go retreat, go to your cave, practice silence, meditate, but come back with something of some use to justify your existence, you peculiar creature. So if the aphorism is entirely my conversation with myself and has no connection whatsoever with the outside world, then I think it's failed. If it's entirely aimed at the outside and I don't feel that it's sort of communicated an inner depth first, then I don't think I'm going to connect with, a stranger in another country from another culture who speaks another language. I think when we tell our bare truth, there is a greater likelihood for one to discover that you've actually been telling a shared truth. It's what we're all struggling with or looking to clarify, but it somehow needed that very personal experience to make it universal. The aphorism afforded me a kind of distance where I could cover up my fingerprints and just see what the essence, the very essence of what I was trying to say, how that could be rescued and sent forth without my disclosing the very intimate, personal, tedious sometimes occasion that might have instigated this thought.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of expressing it, that there's a certain sanitary nature of it that it enables you to appreciate a truth in abstraction in a way that it's kind of refreshing.
I mean, for the longest time, I couldn't use the word I. I thought there's something too small and you don't say I, say one. And now I can say you, and I'm coming to we, but I still have a hard time with the I.
Yeah, we were talking about just the general shallowness of thought that you see reflected in so much of society today, and how much there is out there that it really distracts us away from contemplative, meditative type thought and quality thought. I'm just curious, from a practical standpoint, how you go after the higher quality thoughts. If there are things that you say, I have to stay away from this.
Yes.
I need to discipline myself in this way in order to be able to even get into touch with some of these thoughts that maybe are a little bit hard to pin down unless you're really focused.
Well, I think this is very important. I think it comes down to how we live. What is it that nourishes me? What sustains, what inspires? And it's definitely not the noise or the shallows. Nicholas Carr, in his book, The Shallows, blames the net for quite a bit of, the loss of critical thinking, our shortened attention spans. So even something like Twitter can be so much noise. There's a lot of filtering to do, a lot of sifting to find, you know, the gold or what sustains you, what nourishes you. I'm engaged online. I find it. I cannot dismiss it. I can't turn my back on it because it's the well everyone comes to drink from, and I can't turn my back on something that sustains so many, and they're curious, and I'm curious about them, and we're looking at our own reflections, you know, back at us, and we're helping nudge each other along the way. But it does mean that one has to be fairly strict about the intake, and for me, it means, you know, for example, not watching. For a while, I would watch no television at all. Now it comes down to little television. And it's the same with the internet. The internet for me is a huge sort of double-edged sword. The great wealth that the internet offers, and also the tremendous dangers, yes, of continuously being around that. And I think offline, it extends this kind of caution and restraint. I'll have to, you know, turn down outings, or, you know, tell my wife, you go on out and do X, Y, Z. I can't join you. I think it's a matter of sometimes staying home to just overhear oneself thinking, to read, to try to write. It's an alternative lifestyle. It's not. It means you can't engage with everything all the time.
How about even reading? At what point is reading an impingement to original thought?
That is something I would never have thought that I could say what I'm about to say right now. I always thought reading was absolutely vital, that it's more real than life in some ways. Now I'm entirely of a different opinion. Now I am very selective about what I read. I realize that the moment, if one is fully present to it, is the greatest teacher you can have. And that can be a simple interaction. It can be spending time in silence, meditation, prayer, a walk, a mindful walk, being in nature. All of this, it doesn't just supplement, but can displace reading. Reading is I'm not as fanatical about the centrality of reading to one's well-being as I was before. It's something that I realize is just one way.
So let me just read a few of your aphorisms, if you wouldn't mind, and you could just talk about them a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I'll respond, okay, from the heart to the ones you read to me.
When we think we are stealing from life's fleeting pleasures, we are stealing from our own eternal joy.
This is connected probably to an older one, something I'd written almost 15, maybe 20 years ago. Pleasure may be snatched even from life's clenched fist, but not joy. Joy, like grace, is granted. We get greedy, we get impatient. If we held out, perhaps we'd be given something far greater, but impatience and greed get in the way.
It's the way that a child would look at things, where it's that immediate gratification, mm-hmm, and that unwillingness to forego that for the sake of something that you can't necessarily see. I'll give you another one here. Chance is what we call our failure to understand.
I'm beginning to suspect that perhaps there isn't such a thing as chance, and that if we were quieter and less opinionated and didn't rush to judge or evaluate or analyze, we would see the meaning, if not now, then later on, in what seems arbitrary or even meaningless.
When I read that, it just made me think of how often we dismiss things that we don't understand, and we assume that we see the whole picture when in fact we may see a very tiny part of it.
Exactly. This is very much what I was thinking of.
Here's one more. You said, vice does not require a wide open door to enter. Just a crack will do, or a hairline fissure.
Yes, sir. I am lately, I admit, meditating a great deal on vice and virtue, these big capital V's. I think it's a matter of attention. It's just one, it just takes an instant of inattention for one to topple over and just sort of slide down a staircase that they'd been very carefully climbing up. It's just one instant, you know, this monument that one builds, the monument of their life, even, you know, one moment's inattention can bring that down. So it's me trying to remind myself to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you one more here, Yahia. I think this is a really important statement. In short-sighted times, we can only hope that history will have more foresight than us.
You know, I don't even remember writing that. I don't remember. I would imagine that that had to do with the Egyptian Revolution. I've been bewildered by many recent events. Being an Egyptian away from home, the Egyptian Revolution really did me in and was destabilizing that way. So it's me trying to tell myself, console myself, remind ourselves as Egyptians and people that our ancient wisdom might kick in and remind us of our higher selves, our better angels, that we are not who we seem to be at this unfortunate cultural moment. We can do better. I think I can see this to a certain extent applying within a certain context in America, where I've now made my home. These moments where one is not at full mast, these do not define us. You know, maybe our history has seeds for our future that we can't quite see in this present moment.
Well, there's no doubt that these are short-sighted times and that we are in need of a lot more foresight, that is for sure. Are you willing to share one or two of your sayings that you're particularly pleased with?
Well, I mean, these return to me. Well, there's one about miracles being proud creatures. They will not reveal themselves to those who do not believe. I still believe in this kind of privileged moment when a moment will kind of let you in on its inner workings, the way a shy animal might trust you if you're there and patient and kind enough, you know, and still. I think of life somehow in the same way and people and circumstances. Cynicism now is probably the one thing that I'm most trying to get rid of in myself and in the air around me. And I think this notion of miracles is just sort of the hidden mystery of things. And you have to be willing to let them unfold instead of ridiculing them or taunting them with cynicism.
It reminds me of Jesus Christ actually saying to his Father, "You have revealed these things unto babes. You've hidden them from the wise and prudent, but have revealed them unto babes." Mm-hmm. And there is a humility required of the individual who is really going to be taught.
That's beautiful. We have a saying in Arabic about he, capital H, places his secret in the most unassuming of his creatures. So not the arrogant, pompous, showy, that the one you'd overlook and possibly ridicule, that's the one that's humble and modest enough to have secrets revealed to them. So, you know, just be cautious. Don't get too cocky.
Well, Yahia, I do hope that we have more conversations in the future. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Likewise, Joel. Thank you. It's good to be heard, and I look forward to continuing our conversation.
You've been listening to Yahia Labbabidi. You can find him on Twitter. I'll just spell this for you so you can search for him. YAHIA LABABIDI. And you can find his author page on Amazon.com. He has several books there, including poetry that he's written, essays that he's written. Check him out, and you might even want to start up a conversation. This is Trumpet Hour. I'm your host, Joel Hilliker, managing editor of The Trumpet Magazine and TheTrumpet.com. And I have with me in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, David Vigil, our social media manager for The Trumpet. Hi, David.
Hi, great to be here with you.
This is our Trumpet question and answer segment, and David calls questions submitted to us from online, from our email, social media, and website, And he's going to fire a question at me, and I will do my best to answer them. So let's get started. David, go ahead.
All right. Our first question is taken from the article Shaken, Why the Nepal Earthquake Happened. And this is from Jim. Jim says, whereas I love the historical and spiritual nature of this website and enjoy each of its informative writings, I cannot help but wonder why would a fair and benevolent God target Nepal for correction? These are poor people who in many ways are closer to the way the Lord intended us to live, simple. I can understand if these events occurred in Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, or for that matter, Washington, for these are the centers of truly evil actions and ideologies. The United States has become the bastion of anti-God liberalism. We are the ones in need of correction.
That's an interesting point. I think to look at any single disaster, to look at when something bad happens and to say, well, the people that happened to are more sinful than other people elsewhere is a kind of a rabbit hole that you don't want to go down. In fact, there's actually the example in Luke 13 where Jesus Christ was talking about a really similar example. There was a tower that fell caused several people to die. And he said, you know, don't think that the people who died in that accident were any more sinful than anyone else. He said, actually, the fact that they died is a warning to all of us. Except you repent, you all are going to perish the same way. And that's really the way that we need to look at it, to even say, well, they're not as sinful as the people in the cities and that type of thing. I mean, we are all sinners. That's the truth of the Bible. So we all have to make sure that we're right with God if we're going to be protected in the long run. I think it is important to just look at, say, a disaster or a catastrophe or a tragedy like what happened in Nepal and say, you know, I'm not immune from something like that happening to me. I need to make sure that I'm doing what I need to be doing to get right with God.
Yes, and we also know that these things do happen in the United States from time to time as well. We do have those very local warnings, whether it's tornadoes in Oklahoma or flooding or droughts or hurricanes. And we don't want to forget that either.
That's true. I think it's important to recognize those kinds of things as correction, rather than just looking at it as some kind of arbitrary circumstances or events that happen and it could there's no meaning in it. There's nothing to take from it. I think it is important to say, well, what am I meant to learn from this? What lessons can I take from this? Or what do I need to do differently in my life to protect myself from this type of thing? There is meaning in it. Okay, well, that is all the time we have for questions today. You can send us questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Or you can tweet at us @thetrumpet_com, or you can post on our Facebook or our Google Plus page. Like us and follow us there by searching the Philadelphia Trumpet. Thank you very much, David, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
We're going to conclude the show this week with a very important public service announcement. What are you doing right now? You're probably engaged in a highly dangerous activity, sitting. If you're like the average American, you sit at breakfast, you sit in the car, you sit in class or the office, you sit at lunch, you sit at dinner, and you sit in front of the television for a total of 14 and a half hours every day. The New York Times wrote this: "This is your body on chairs. Electrical activity in the muscles drops. The muscles go as silent as those of a dead horse, leading to a cascade of harmful metabolic effects. Your calorie burning rate immediately plunges to about 1 per minute, a third of what it would be if you got up and walked. Insulin effectiveness drops within a single day, and the risk of developing type 2 diabetes rises. So does the risk of being obese." Why is sitting so harmful? Well, when you don't use your muscles, they don't contract. And when muscles don't contract, they don't use as much fuel. Extra blood sugar accumulates in your bloodstream, which boosts your risk for diabetes and other diseases. That Times article cited a study where researchers looking at 14 young, fit, thin volunteers, after only 24 hours of being sedentary, their body's ability to uptake glucose dropped 40%. Sitting also leads to back soreness, constipation, and other problems. Gretchen Reynolds, another New York Times writer, highlighted another study on the effects of sitting. In her book, The First 20 Minutes, she wrote this: those who sat the most had a 112% increase in their relative risk of developing diabetes, 147% increase in their risk for cardiovascular disease, and a 49% greater risk of dying prematurely, even if they regularly exercised. Ouch. Our bodies were designed to move, to walk, lift, climb, run, jump, work. We need to be active. Stagnating always causes problems. Yet so many people just want to sit. Sit in class, sit on the job if they can, sit on the couch and zone out. Mayo Clinic researcher Dr. James Levine says that inertia sickens more than just our body. It sickens our mind. Not only do we naturally want to take it easy and have a seat physically, we tend to do the same mentally and even spiritually. We have to fight this tendency, otherwise we'll suffer the mental and spiritual corollaries of those negative physical effects of the sluggish, sit-on-your-rear lifestyle. The Christian life is one of driving yourself, challenging yourself, remaining active in personal development, improvement, study, education. Thomas Edison said, "Opportunity is missed by most people because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work." While we're young, we need to keep busy, gather productive, upbuilding experiences, set goals, plan, and go after our lifelong education. And once we're done with formal education, we have to set our own curriculum to ensure we're still stimulating our minds. Be active in study. Digest high-quality books, even lectures. It's amazing what education is available on the internet and in your local community, a lot of it for free. Exploit contacts. Travel, and most important, think about what you hear and read. Keep active in order to avoid the mental equivalents of diabetes, disease, and obesity. The New Living Translation of Proverbs 13 and verse 4 says, "Lazy people want much but get little, but those who work hard will prosper." In his book, The Seven Laws of Success, educator Herbert W. Armstrong wrote this: "Success is accomplishment. It is doing. They say any old dead fish can float downstream, but it takes a live one to swim up. An inactive person will not accomplish. Accomplishment is doing." The fourth law of success, then, is drive. Half-hearted effort might carry one a little way toward his goal, but it will never get him far enough to reach it. How much drive do you have? How do you use your hours outside of work or school? How much me time do you reward yourself with to relax and do nothing? Are you physically and mentally sitting your life away? Push yourself forward. Be diligent. Don't be a dead horse or an old dead fish. Get up and do. Ephesians 5 and verse 16 encourages all of us to be redeeming the time, for the days are evil. God made us to move. So get active, physically, mentally, and spiritually. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. You go there and you can actually request a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. You can follow me @Joel_Hilliker, H-I-L-L-I-K-E-R. You can find us on Facebook or Google+. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley and Yahia Lababidi. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Mr. Lababidi: Freedom is not needing to have an opinion on everything. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.